Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The anti-Russia witch hunt in the United States continues as Attorney General Jeff Sessions has recused himself from the Justice Department investigation into Russian influence, alleged influence, and faces calls for his resignation, not for his record of extreme racism, not for his position on immigrants, but because of routine meetings with the Russian ambassador to the United States. Donald Trump spoke yesterday in the USS Ford supercarrier, touting his administration's plans for a massive military buildup. Will this spark a global arms race? Is one already underway? The International Monetary Fund turned 70 years old this week, an essential pillar of the U.S.-created post-World War II world order. The IMF has spread, though, misery, debt, and free market dogma around the world. But first, we turn to the controversy around Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions yesterday announced that he would recuse himself from the ongoing Justice Department investigation into alleged links between Russia and the 2016 election. We are joined from New York by Don DeBar. He is the host of CPR News for Community Progressive Radio. And from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome back, Alexander and Don.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Alexander, the breaking news yesterday was that Jeff Sessions recused himself from the ongoing Justice Department investigation about alleged Russian manipulation of the 2016 election. When Sessions did that, when he recused himself, he didn't stand back from his earlier assertions that his discussions with the Russian ambassador were routine and that he did nothing wrong and that, in fact, he did not commit perjury to the question posed to him during the confirmation hearings. Yesterday, you wrote an article that said there was, in fact, nothing secret about either of Jeff Sessions' meetings with the Russian ambassador, only one of which was held in private. It is not disputed that Sessions on both occasions met with the ambassador in his official capacity as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. There was nothing irregular about these meetings, Sessions insists. So go ahead, talk about your view. Does the fact that Sessions has recused himself, it's not an admission of guilt. It just means that the Trump administration has decided to avoid that bullet, it seems to me.
It has. And I think actually that it was the correct decision, because given the way in which this thing was playing out, he couldn't very well be the person to whom this FBI investigation, which is underway between contacts, alleged contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russians, he couldn't be the person who would be reported to, because it is now quite likely that he will be questioned on it. That is not unusual. Attorney generals in the same situation have had to do that before. I would say something, though. This situation should never have arisen, not because of what Jeff Sessions did as a member of the House of the Senate Armed Services Committee, but because of the way in which this whole issue has now been blown up. There is no real evidence here of any kind of impropriety. There is no suggestion of secrecy about what he did. It is perfectly routine for him to meet with foreign ambassadors. And on this occasion, he met with the Russian ambassador on one occasion at an event hosted by the Right Wing Heritage Foundation. Out of nothing, a huge story and a huge charge has been spun. And I think that is an extremely disturbing development for the United States, because it makes it, frankly, look to me like a witch hunt.
Don DeBar, there are many reasons one might criticize Jeff Sessions. He couldn't even make it as Ronald Reagan's federal district court judge nominee in the 1980s because of his overt racism that was documented, and I think Reagan pulled the nomination. his position on immigration has been very retrograde. But when you hear the storm, the turbulence, the attack on Sessions now from the Democratic Party, not because of immigration, not because of racism, not because of all the things that you can, you know, you could say Jeff Sessions is a good target, but because he dared to meet with the Russian ambassador and then dared to say when asked whether he had been in contact with Russia during the election campaign about the campaign, he said no. Now, first of all, it seems to me that that shouldn't even be a question, really, for a confirmation hearing, because meetings between members of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate and members of other parts of the U.S. government and even members of the U.S. population with foreign ambassadors is not unusual. It's a commonplace. But these are indications that we are now in a full-blown, nonstop witch hunt against Russia. What accounts for it?
I mean, first of all, you know, you're right to characterize this as just the due course of business. I'm a journalist. In mid-January, I met with the Russian ambassador to the United Nations at a cocktail party. That's what we do. Okay. You know, this the attack, first of all, you know, the nature of it, you know, framing it. In other words, instead of attacking Sessions for racism, for his views on the Voting Rights Act or, you know, whatever, they use this Russian boogaboo because that is the, you know, ideological, for lack of a better word, it's not an ideology, but this, you know, caricature of an ideological attack on the enemies of the power elite in this country. I don't know what the intent is. One scary possibility, of course, is they're preparing the American public for war, because when they did this with people, you know, mobilizing against Iraq, mobilizing against Libya, mobilizing against Syria, the next thing you know, the target country was a target and no longer a country. And so that maybe that's what's motivating it. But, you know, as a political attack with all of that, and then there's, you know, the framework, it's pretty thin, almost to non-existence, of a legal attack where they're talking essentially that he got stuck in a perjury trap at these hearings. And, you know, if you look at the testimony that he gave, the oral testimony that he gave to Al Franken, there's no perjury there. But then they've been pointing to this written testimony that is in response to a question from Senator Pat Leahy. He's a Democrat from Vermont, that said specifically in quotes here, "Have you been in contact with anyone connected to any part of the Russian government about the 2016 election, either before or after Election Day? Question mark. Closed quote." Sessions' answer was one word: no. Now, that's not perjury unless they were talking about, you know, conspiring with essentially the Russians about the election. And of course, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. So, you know, to me, you have to look at the attack on Sessions in terms of the strategic attack on Trump. He's the head of the Justice Department. He's the president's lawyer. He's not, you know, the counsel to the president, but he is the attorney for the administration. And if you can take him out, as these massive legal attacks on, he signs executive orders, legislation that's coming, whatever other things that the president tries to do, as they attack him, if the Justice Department is in disarray, it's very hard to defend against that. And you have to consider it within that strategic framework, I think.
Alexander Mercuris, what do you expect? I mean, right now, Trump is standing behind Sessions. He said he has 100% confidence in Sessions on this issue. Obviously, he had confidence in him before because Sessions was one of the first senators to come out and support Trump way back when. He was repaid for that by being given the attorney general position. How do you think this is going to end up?
I think that the president, Donald Trump, will be extremely reluctant to get rid of Jeff Sessions. If you look at the whole dynamic of Donald Trump's rise to the presidency, Jeff Sessions was one of the key people at the start to come out and support him. And he is a central figure in the administration. And he is a friend, a personal friend, apparently, of the president and also a very strong political ally of the president. I think the president will stand by him. And I don't think he will go. And I think he will stand his ground. I think it will be too much damage to the president for him to let him go. This is not a Michael Flynn type situation where the president could let Michael Flynn go and he would continue intact. So I think the president will stand behind him. I think this campaign, however, will continue. And can I say something going back to some of the things you said, it's a very difficult situation for somebody like me, myself, because basically I cannot imagine any other situation where I would be talking up for someone like Jeff Sessions. His views and mine are diametrically opposed on most things. You've talked about his open racism. You've talked about his issue on immigration. Well, what we're having is, because we're having a polarization around this false issue of Russia, people who might be opposing Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump and the administration on appropriate issues are now finding themselves perforce forced to defend them. And I think that is something that people in the United States who are behind this campaign and who are doing it from liberal left-wing positions, if you wish, really need to think about very carefully. Is it really wise for them to become involved in what is, frankly, a witch hunt?
Well, I think there's, speaking personally as someone who is from the left in the United States and part of the anti-war movement, and someone who has been, you know, the group that I lead, the Answer Coalition, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. I mean, we've been against the immigrant bashing. We've been against the attacks on Muslims. We're standing with those communities. And I have to tell you, within the United States movement, and I think it's important for the international audience to understand this, there is a sharp division between those who are lining up with the Democratic Party, who will do anything against Trump, meaning using this Russia-bashing witch hunt against Trump, and those of us who disagree with Trump's domestic policies in particular, and also his foreign policy when it comes to expanding the military budget, et cetera, or hostility towards Iran. I mean, there is an open struggle right now that's going on within the anti-Trump movement, because people like Move On, which are right now having protests demanding that Jeff Sessions resign because he talked to the Russian ambassador. The rest of the movement, the grassroots movement, rejects that. But the mainstream media doesn't cover the rest of that movement. They cover these kind of anti-Russia bashing things. So one might get the impression that if you're against Trump, you're also endorsing the anti-Russia position. And I have to tell you, millions of people reject it. Millions do.
And that is very important. And that is a very important, that is a crucial fact.
Go ahead, Don DeBar.
It may be an existential fact, an existential level fact. You have to think in strategic terms. There, those of us that would like to see, or those that would like to see Trump, now run out of office on a rail, have to consider that something will come next. And the way things are established right now, you either have a continuation of the constitutional order, which means President Pence, or if they do an Agnew on him, you have President Ryan, or if this is a slower moving train and it takes until 2002 and say Hillary Clinton runs for Nita Lowey's seat, gets elected Speaker of the House, we have President Clinton. All of those roads lead to war with Russia unless there's some major sea change somewhere else. But it seems that the motivating factor has to be this divergence in opinion or approach towards Russia between the establishment and Trump. Because in almost every other area, look, I can't see the elite lining up with people in the streets against racism. It has never happened before. Against Islamophobia, they've been bombing Muslims for the last 20-some-odd years. Against, you know, these rise of anti-immigrant sentiment, they've been stoking it and using it, they've weaponized it against workers in this country for three decades now. The point of divergence is policy towards Russia. And if Trump is the only thing standing between us and Russia, we need to think strategically about what it means to get him out of the way.
Okay, Alexander, I'm not sure, really, I'm not sure that Trump will actually have a point of real departure towards Russia. It seems to me that Mattis, Pompeo, Pence, all of the people Trump himself has selected, they have a very hostile attitude. They have the traditional Washington consensus hostility towards Russia. Obama said when he came in, he was for resetting relations, and so did George W. Bush. There's an inherent sort of foundational problem that the U.S. establishment has with Russia, not because Russia is necessarily being aggressive, but because it exists because it functions as an obstacle to complete absolute U.S. hegemony. And it seems to me that that sort of pattern isn't going to change no matter what. What do you think?
Well, I actually am afraid in the end agree, because I'm not really sure what Donald Trump's ideas about Russia are. He's talked at various times about wanting better relations with Russia, but I'm not quite sure what exactly he means by that, whether in fact he wants to work with the Russians and to establish a more peaceful relationship, or whether it's somehow a more manipulative arrangement whereby he gets the Russians to do various things and in return gives them something back. It's very difficult to say. But the default position in the United States over the last decade, and in fact much more than that, far more than that, has been hostility to Russia. And one can't just look to Donald Trump. In fact, one definitely shouldn't look to Donald Trump as the person who's going to change that. That has to come from people like the anti-war movement that you were talking about, from people in the media like the ones that Don works with. There has to be a change and a greater understanding amongst the American public that this policy is misconceived and wrong and dangerous. And I think, actually, there is some signs that that might be happening. After all, Donald Trump, who says that he wants better relations with Russia, managed to get elected. So I think one has to work on that, not rely on Donald Trump. But there is something else about this, which is, of course, there's also the concern about the constitutional order of the United States, which is what Don DeBar was talking about. If Donald Trump or his administration is are somehow changed or removed as a result of this kind of extraordinary witch hunt, then it tells us a great deal about how the United States works now. And frankly, it is something that is extremely disturbing. It would mean that people, when they vote for elections, no longer have a meaningful vote in those elections, because there are sinister and powerful forces behind the scenes that are able to change things and are able to do this by manipulating the media, by inventing stories, by invoking the Russian bogey, by doing all sorts of things like the kind that we have just seen.
Well, that's all the time we have. We want to thank Don DeBar and Alexander Mercuris. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump spoke yesterday in the USS Ford supercarrier, touting his administration's plans for a massive U.S. military buildup. Will this spark a global arms race? We are joined from Moscow by international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you for joining. In his speech yesterday, President Trump called for, quote, a great rebuilding of the United States military and the United States Navy. Rebuilding. Okay, it sounds to me like if one dropped here on the planet Earth from, say, Mars and heard that speech, you would get the impression that the U.S. military was pretty depleted, pretty weak, pretty underfunded. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a huge misnomer. The U.S. is already spending more than seven times the next seven countries put together. Budget is around $600 billion, with another extra a few tens of billions of dollars in overseas discretionary spending, which is the spending for its foreign wars, which is considered a separate item. It's not even included in the defense budget spending. But there are a lot of misnomers, not only in the way that the Trump administration is promoting this increase in military spending, but in the way most of them media is reporting it. Of course, they're going for the big salacious headlines. It is not actually a $54 billion increase in current military spending. That is in reference to the 2011 sequestration cuts that were designed for military spending caps. Technically, they're still in place, but every year since they were put in place, they have been overridden by temporary budget bridges. And this was intended. They were never actually supposed to be quite as Spartan as they're actually written. This is a whole lot of sleight in hand and political rigmarole going on there. So actually, the increase is only going to be about $20 billion on what the U.S. Has been spending in the last few years of the Obama administration. So it's not quite as huge as it sounds. It's not actually a 10% increase in military spending. It's actually only going to be about a 3% increase in military spending. And the jump in military spending that it represents is by far not the largest, certainly not in modern history. Since 1977, there have been 27 larger cuts in the military spending, and there have been four since 2002 that were larger.
Larger cuts or larger increases?
Larger increases, beg my pardon. The larger increases, including the first 2 years of the Obama administration, 2008 and 2009, where the spending increases were larger than what Trump is proposing.
Donald Trump, when he spoke before Congress on Tuesday and motivated his military budget, his defense increase, he said this: a budget that rebuilds the military, eliminates the defense sequester, and calls for one of the largest increases in national defense spending in American history. So what you're saying is that that's kind of hoopla. He's playing to the crowd.
Absolutely. And fault to a lot of the media, the way it is reporting it. I'll direct you to Foreign Affairs, Mother Jones, some sources that are covering the actual number crunching of what this actually amounts to. In fact, several prominent neocons like John McCain have been very vocal in saying that the increase in spending is not near enough to make up for what he considers the deprivation of the U.S. military during the years of the sequestration, which were never, in fact, largely put in place to begin with. So there's a lot of rhetoric. There's a lot of sleight in hand. It does represent an increase in military spending on current, but much smaller than is being forecast. And he is asking to do quite a lot with that increase. He's talking a lot of new ships, a lot of new fighter aircraft, but he's also proposing a 10% increase in the combat personnel of each of the four major military services. And I don't know how he's going to do that with just the actual increase that he is proposing. And he's also proposing to do this. I don't know how his budget is going to add up with cuts in what he considers discretionary spending. In particular, the State Department will be looking at a huge cut. The Environmental Protection Agency, the Humanities and the Arts, all of this will be cut because he is promising to do this budget with an increase not only in military spending, but in law enforcement, intelligence, and border security, including his vaunted wall, which he's going to end up paying for, at least on the front, while at the same time not cutting Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, which he has promised not to do, and promising tax cuts at the same time. So he is there. They will be proposing a much more detailed budget in within a month, just over a month. But this is going to be extremely controversial, both by the Republicans who want cuts in the big entitlement spending in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and by the Democrats who will certainly be against the cuts in things like the State Department's budget and the Environmental Protection Agency and Arts and Humanities. So I do not see that this budget will emerge in anything like its current form. I don't think the numbers are going to add up anyway. But Steve Bannon has promised that Trump intends to dismantle what he calls the administrative state. Obviously, they mean certain factions of the state that they disagree with, not necessarily the military.
Interesting. Just help the audience also understand what sequestration is. I mean, that's a Washington word. You know, it comes from the so-called budget compromise after a budget impasse between Obama and the Congress. But sequestration was supposed to be across the board, including spending on all programs. And of course, from day one, the Pentagon hollered, well, you're putting national security at risk by limiting the budget for the military. And that would, of course, be different than, say, cutting money from Environmental Protection Agency or from the arts or the humanities or housing or whatever. Just explain where it comes from.
What it simply amounts to is spending caps that were intended to lower the budget deficit. They never actually did. President Obama's budget deficit continued at large levels throughout his administration. The federal debt after his 8 years of presidency doubled from around $10 trillion to nearly $20 trillion. And that's just the federal budget deficit. That's not even talking the states, the municipalities, of course, and so on. So it was proposed spending cuts. They were never spending caps. They were never actually supposed to be as Spartan as they are on paper, because it was planned that every year there would be these budget bridges that would actually increase the spending of these things, in particular the military, back up substantially. So when Trump is promising a $54 billion increase, that is on these theoretical, on paper, 2011 spending caps per the sequestration that were never actually enacted anyway, and the $54 billion thus becomes $20 billion increase.
Indeed. And so we have a situation where, again, the public narrative, whether you support or disapprove of the Trump budget plans, the idea is the United States military is a suffering institution, that the country's security is at risk, that the United States has slipped behind. And there's all kinds of media stories that come up about great advances that Russia has made or that China is making, again, sort of signaling that the United States is falling behind its main rivals, main adversaries, other great powers. We've been there before. We know how this worked. When Sputnik, not our radio station, but the satellite was sent up into space in 1957, that created panic in Washington, or it was used at least to create panic, that now the United States was slipping behind the Soviet Union or the Russians, and that became the spur for a great arms race. Do you see a new arms race?
Oh, absolutely. It's already begun. It didn't start with Trump. It started during the earliest days of the last administration. There is indeed a lot of new, shall we say, missile gap. We're not talking necessarily just a missile gap, although there is plenty of reference to hypersonic weapons, missiles, and so on that Russia and China are developing, as well as the United States. To put it into perspective, if we take on face value the $54 billion increase that Trump is promising, that alone is equal, actually slightly greater than the entire Russian military budget, which is around $50 billion for 2016. And it's expected to stay right around the same level going into the next year in Russia as well. China spends about $121 billion, which is less than one-third of what the United States spends. The other big military spenders are the United Kingdom, a U.S. ally, which spends, again, just slightly more than Russia. Saudi Arabia, also a major U.S. ally who buys most of their weapons from the U.S. military-industrial complex. Obama sold them $120 billion worth of arms. They're also spending more than the Russian Federation is, and have been for the last several years. Russia actually only comes in at six in terms of big military spenders. And right after Russia comes the other major Western powers, including France and Germany. So when we talk about the huge threat that Russia and China, you know, present to the United States, it really has to be taken with a grain of salt. Of course, relative to the years of the 1990s when the Russian military nearly collapsed, yes, Russia is increasing its capability relative to those years. But it's certainly nothing close to the relative parity in conventional forces, at least as it was presented during the Cold War. It wasn't actually parity. The Soviet Union was still far behind in both conventional and strategic forces, but it's even less now. But Russia, since the 1990s, both Russia and China have increased their militaries to the point where within their own regional theaters, they can now potentially stop U.S. military action. And that's what cannot be tolerated, because the U.S., while decrying that Russia and China are claiming spheres of interest in their own, claims the whole world as its, and the Western hegemony as a whole's, legitimate realm of interest to interfere in, whether that's in the South China Sea off China's coast or in the Baltic and Black Seas off Russia's coast, both, you know, quite far on the other side of the world from U.S. shores. So this is really what it's all about, is hegemony and the ability to resist hegemony. Again, not on a global scale. The U.S. military is so far substantially ahead of any of its potential rivals. It's not even, you know, funny. It's actually quite scary. There's a great deal being made that China may gain one foreign military base in Djibouti on the east coast of Africa that is close to a U.S. military base, where depending on exactly what you count as a military base, China may have one foreign military base, and the U.S. is talking about 800 to 1,000, or possibly more, depending on what you count and what you don't. But, the scale of that, and Russia has a handful, less than a dozen, and all within the former Soviet Union, while the U.S.'s are spread around the world. And that is a big part of this gigantic military budget that U.S. taxpayers are charged for, this overseas empire, which is really just the way the old British Empire did, and the same thing.
Mark, let me just ask you, we only have a couple minutes left. Trump also talked about, quote, the 12 carrier Navy we need. We also need modernized aircraft. Additionally, we must improve our cyber capabilities. That's when he was speaking on the deck of the USS Gerald Ford, a boat that cost, you said, about $13 billion.
Yes, the most expensive warship in the world history.
Yeah, and he had that Air Force bomber jacket on and hat, like the way George W. Bush dressed up. They're all playing G.I. Joe, these presidents who actually didn't serve in the military, but when they get on aircraft carriers, I guess they have fun doing that. That's what Bush did when he said mission accomplished on May 1st, 2003, which was pertaining to the Iraq War, which obviously they're still fighting in Iraq. But what's the 12-carrier Navy? I mean, why does the U.S. need a 12-carrier Navy? What's that all about? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, it's all about power projection. It's all about being able to put carriers simultaneously in the Gulf, in the Atlantic, and in the Mediterranean, and in the Pacific, while having enough rotation, considering for some to be at home. And this comes as China is getting ready to finalize their second carrier. One of them is a refurbished old Soviet carrier, but China has plans for a number of more. Russia has tentative plans for carriers, but they're not going to happen. Trump is definitely trying to present himself as a war president. What remains to be seen with this military increase and the way he's presenting himself with this mission accomplished moment, I agree, is where he uses this military. During his speech, he again mentions terrorism, 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 but we saw the war on terror was extended largely into a war against tribal Islam across the length of the Islamic world, you know, from Libya all the way to Afghanistan and beyond, the Philippines and Indonesia even. So it remains to be seen what exactly Trump intends to use this military, this increased military spending for. And he certainly is trying trying to jingoistically proclaim himself a war president.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. We've been talking from Moscow with Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, turned 70 years old this week. Well, it began financial operations 70 years ago this week. The IMF is an essential pillar of the post-World War II order. The IMF has spread misery, debt, and free market dogma all around the world. We are joined from New York City by Pete Dolak, an organizer with Trade Justice New York Metro. He is the author of the book, It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. And you can find his writing on the Systemic Disorder blog. Welcome back, Pete.
Oh, glad to be here, Brian.
Thanks for joining. So the IMF began its financial operations this week, 70 years ago. Talk about its track record. The elite certainly hold it in high regard, but what about the people of the world?
Well, the working people of the world would certainly not feel the way that the elites did. No surprise there. The IMF, as you just indicated, has been a real pillar, along with the World Bank, of the whole so-called Bretton Woods post-World War II system. And, of course, the IMF's basic task is to impose austerity on as many countries as possible. Just it's the same policies, one size fits all, of course, from the elites' standpoint, it's a wonderful thing. If you're a working person, not so good, of course. It's always mass privatizations, currency devaluations, cuts to wages, shredding of social safety nets, and of course the governments who receive these debts, their highest priority is now going to be paying debt. And this is the same philosophy in the same conditions, no matter what the state of a country given is. It's imposed on that. And you know, we can go around the world a little bit. For instance, in Chile, of course, with the infamous Pinochet and the infamous Milton Friedman made their mark there. The results there were a poverty rate in Chile going up to 40%. One-third of Chileans were unemployed. This, at the same time, massive subsidies were giving to corporations there. And the social security system of Chile was privatized. It was so bad that if you had retired in 2005, you actually would receive less than half of what you would have received had the social security system stayed in state public hands. Now, interestingly enough, this is one of the things that the IMF has praised as an example to be emulated. And just last year, in about June of 2016, the IMF issued a report, and it was titled Neoliberalism Oversold with a question mark. And I was intrigued by this because I thought, could the IMF really be questioning neoliberalism, questioning austerity? Well, it turns out, no, they really didn't. They thought, well, okay, you know, maybe our calculations are off a little bit and we need to make some little tiny tweaks here and there, but otherwise everything is just wonderful. And right, of course, after raising this question, right on the very first page of this paper, they hail the Pinochet-era Chile as a model widely emulated around the world and pleasingly quoted Milton Friedman, who proclaimed Chile in 1982 to be an economic miracle. Of course, all the people out of work, all the people who were killed, tortured in jails, who had to flee into exile, well, maybe they might have a little bit of a different opinion there. We could take a look at Jamaica. In 2015, the gross domestic product, while not the most perfect metric to really tell what's an economy going for working people, but it's still a useful statistic. In 2015, Jamaica's gross domestic product was actually lower than it had been 20 years earlier. And in that same year and the following year, 2016, Jamaica paid four times more just on the interest of their debt, not even touching the principal, just four times more on the interest than the government was able to spend on capital expenditures. And the year before, in 2014, Jamaica had received a fresh IMF loan. And despite that, they still paid more to the IMF for the previous loans they got than they actually received in that loan. So all you do is these countries just dig themselves a bigger and bigger hole for themselves. Then we could look at Greece, of course, an example that's pretty well known at there. In 2013, the IMF issued a report on Greece where it congratulated itself for the splendid job that it had done. And what was the state of Greece at this point? 27% unemployment. The economy had shrunk 20%. I think it's shrunk about 25% by now. One of every 10 Greek children were going to bed hungry. And what did the IMF solution to this? Why, more layoffs, accelerating privatizations, and that Greeks really need to regain their confidence. So that's just a small sample of the results of the IMF around the world, and similar results in many, many other countries and on every continent on Earth.
Pete Dulick, the IMF was one of several post-World War II institutions that constituted the American vision, meaning the U.S. ruling circle's vision of what a post-World War II order would look like. So you have the United Nations, you have the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, those three. And of course, as you mentioned, a Bretton Woods conference whereby the dollar, the U.S. dollar, the dollar printed by the U.S. Treasury became the world currency, the world dominant currency. Those were the sort of pillars of that. Now, help the audience understand, because during the post-World War II era, there was also the beginning of rapid decolonization. Those countries that had been the literal colonies of the British, the French, of course, the Germans, the Japanese, the Dutch, all of the major European capitalist powers and Japan had divided the world amongst themselves as colonies or semi-colonies or spheres of influence. They were becoming independent countries. But it seems to me what you're talking about is that this kind of debt domination is a new form of colonialism. In other words, in order to breathe economically, countries need credit. They need to be able to finance trade. They need to be able to finance their own industrial or agricultural development. They need credit. And the credit and the source of credit was essentially monopolized and in the hands of the same colonial powers, but in this case, with more power given to the United States, which was a latecomer to the colonial acquisition process, but still one of the imperial powers and the dominant power that brought all the former colonial powers together as more or less junior partners in the post-World War II era. Is that what you're saying, that this is kind of a new form of colonialism? And talk again, why can countries not escape it?
A new form of colonialism, I think, is an excellent way. I would certainly agree with that description, Brian. As countries did formally become independent, again, independent in a formal sense, they didn't really become independent because the means of control just shifted in different ways. You know, it goes from being a direct colonial relationship to installing a friendly local dictator, and then when that's not viable anymore, well, then you've get a financial web, and that's kind of the stage of world capitalism that we're in right now. So what happens is, as you just said, countries have needs, they don't have a lot of capital, so the idea is, well, okay, here comes the World Bank, which will give loans for specific projects, and the IMF, which will give a loan that's not tied to a specific problem or project, but, you know, just a more to meet more general needs or to even pay back debt, which is its own hamster wheel on its own. So what happens is they go there and it says, okay, you know, we're having our difficulties. And, of course, these countries are all on the receiving end of a lot of imperialist policies where multinational capital from the global north goes in there and basically extracts wealth and takes it out. So these governments don't really have the money or the means to really create the local infrastructure and provide for education and all the other needs that a government really ought to be able to do. So they go to the World Bank or the IMF, often it's to the IMF, and the IMF says, ah, okay, yes, we can see you have some needs here. So, yes, we'll be glad to give you some money. But, and then all the conditions, as we said before, so they have to do this. And, of course, this enables Northern capital to extract still more money out of it. It miserates people more as people are thrown out of work and have less of a social safety net to fall back on. And now, of course, the government gets itself in more debt. So they've got to go back to the IMF again and say, gee, you know, we need a fresh loan. We're really struggling here. And the IMF says, oh, okay, I can see you're having difficulties here. Yes, of course, that's what we're here for. We're here to help. We'll give you more funds. And, of course, but, you know, you need to privatize more. You need to cut wages more. You need to open up your economy to northern capital some more. And it's just this vicious circle that keeps going and going and going. So as long as you stay within the system, there's no way out of it. You just keep getting yourself deeper in debt. I mean, ultimately, the only solution is to just overthrow the whole system and have a much more rational system that's based on human need and not corporate profits.
It's really something when you think about what happens to countries that defy the dictates of the United States, say it was Iraq or Iran earlier and then continuing, or Libya or Syria or North Korea or Cuba, countries that have independent governments that have been targeted by the United States. The United States makes it impossible for them to obtain credit. They are sanctioned. They are the victims of economic sanctions. Countries can't trade and they can't obtain credit. Even now in Cuba, international banks are still being fined even after the United States opened embassies in an embassy in Havana and Havana opened an embassy in Washington. International banks are still being fined in U.S. courts and by the U.S. government for having provided credit to Cuba so that it could trade. So sanctions are one tool. That's the deprivation of access to credit. But then if you get credit, the strings attached are such that you also become ensnared. So in other words, there's no really open road for developing countries unless they're very, very large, say like China, for instance. But there's almost no road. It's either sanctions or investment, but the investment or the credit comes with such a high price.
Right. The world capitalist system is set up that way. You have your sphere of top dogs, as it were, Canada, U.S., Europe, and Japan. And, you know, a couple of countries in East Asia after World War II were allowed to rise. Japan was allowed, and I guess Taiwan and South Korea. But that's about it. There really isn't any more room at the top. And I think that was kind of a strategic decision that, okay, we need some allies in East Asia because, of course, you had a revolution in China in 1947 that they wanted to counter. So they needed to kind of replicate their system of allies in Europe in East Asia. So certain countries were kind of like the first ones to go. They were allowed to do that, but there really isn't any room for anybody else. You know, other countries, you know, the Bangladeshes and the Vietnams, they're based on, on low-cost wager and an economy based on sweatshops, which just produce for Western multinational capital. So, again, the way the system is set up, you know, there's only so much room at the top of the pyramid. The same is, you know, in the case of individual wealth. You know, you have a handful of billionaires at the top, and then you have a small strata of maybe upper middle class people who are doing okay. You know, the corporate lawyers and doctors and people like that, people who basically serve the billionaires at the top of the pyramid, and then you have a vast span of people who are kept down because there just isn't any room for them. And the international pecking order works in a similar way. It's a very hierarchical system. So as long as these countries remain mired in the world capitalist system, the deck is totally stacked against them, and they don't really have a prospect of advancing very far, unless, as you pointed out, in the case of China, because it's so big, it can kind of force concessions and can say, well, hey, if you know, we got a billion people here. If you want to play ball with us, if you want to do business in here, well, you're going to have to do it on our terms. But a small country or a typical country just isn't big enough to do that, so they don't really have any means to resist.
Pete Dulick, we just have a couple minutes left. We have 3 minutes left, to be precise. During the time that the Soviet Union existed up until 1991, there was a second world economy, the socialist bloc economy, and that economy traded and provided both trade, economic intercourse, and financial and assistance of other economic types to emerging countries or to the non or post-colonial regimes that were developing in Latin America, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia. After the Soviet Union collapsed, that second world market, which was, of course, smaller than the capitalist world market, but still it existed, that vanished. And at that point, many of the third world countries lost any possible alternative to buying into the existing world capitalist economy on the terms of the world capitalist economy. And it seems to me that that really is the time period when structural adjustment programs became dominant. They had existed before, but they became dominant as an IMF tool. In our last couple minutes, talk about what the structural adjustment program is and how it applies.
Okay, structural adjustment, again, is coming in where, okay, we'll give you the loan, but you've got to do all these things, and none of these things are in the interest of the working people of the country getting the loan. They're in the interest of multinational capital from the global north that wants to go in and take over their economy or just extract as much wealth out as they possibly can. So first off, it's always mass privatization of state assets, which, of course, is sold off at fire sale prices way below the actual value.
And then international corporations, say U.S. or European, can also then buy those now privatized, previously nationalized companies.
Yes, exactly. Like Argentina, for instance, is a good example of the 1990s. After the military junta was finally overthrown and the so-called formal democracy was put in, they were offered these wonderful structural adjustment deals. So they sold off all their assets. But they had taken on so much debt during the military era from arms buying and other things that the foreign debt of Argentina actually rose after they sold off all these state assets because they're sold off at such a cheap rate. They also insist on cuts to wages and cuts to the social safety net. Don't want money being wasted on things like education and health care. We can't have anything like that. And, of course, they have to make their highest priority debt. In the case of Greece, for instance, they actually insisted it be written into the Constitution that the debt to foreign speculators would actually be paid before any other state expenditures, and that's been replicated in some other countries. So again, it's the same one-size-fit-all, not for the benefit of the country receiving it, but for the benefit of the multinational corporations that want to go in there and extract as much wealth as they possibly can.
Yeah, the debt trap, also we might call it the new colonialism. We've been joined from New York by Pete Dolak, an organizer with Trade Justice New York Metro. He is the author of the book, It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment, and you can find his writing on the Systemic Disorder blog. Pete, we'll get back to you soon, hopefully, to pursue this story. We're out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.